Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We begin today with our week in review. And of course, the big story was the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act.
As the news of the ruling broke yesterday, some in Massachusetts responded with joy. Here's the Reverend Byrne Stanfield, president of the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization.
We are elated. We are thrilled. We are ready to sing from the mountaintops with all the prophets of our religious traditions.
Governor Deval Patrick also hailed the historic ruling.
Today's decision is a victory for the American people. We have already shown here in Massachusetts how economically important and morally right health care reform can be.
But there were also notes of caution and skepticism, including this one from former Governor Michael Dukakis.
I don't think we ought to kid ourselves. If Romney is elected, that's the end of the Affordable Care Act.
And from Senator Scott Brown.
Regardless of its constitutionality, this heavy-handed, one-size-fits-all health care law is not right for Massachusetts or our nation.
There was also other news this week, including claims by Whitey Bulger's attorney that the government promised the Boston mobster immunity.
And in the race for the North Shore's congressional seat, incumbent Democrat John Tierney is being challenged by a moderate Republican and a scandal.
With us now to talk about all of that and more are two stalwarts from our Week in Review team, Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Good to have you. And Bruce Moll, editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Good to see you, Bruce.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start with yesterday's historic Supreme Court decision upholding the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. So the ruling has huge political and economic consequences for the nation, even if there was really less at stake in Massachusetts because we have our own universal health care law. The federal law remains unpopular across much of the nation, but here's MIT economist Jonathan Gruber, who says that could change.
Look at Massachusetts. We have two-thirds public support for what is basically the same law. That's not that we're some crazy liberal state. The two-thirds reflects the fact that once you understand what's in this law, you like it.
Peter, let me start with you. Do you agree with Jonathan Gruber on that score, that as Americans become more acquainted with some of the benefits of the law, they'll come to embrace it, as Massachusetts has?
I think that it'll get a little bit more popular. I don't think it's going to be widely embraced like Medicare or Medicaid because it's not an entitlement in itself. It's sort of a framework for dealing with a lot of other questions. So as time goes by, component parts of it will become more and more and more popular, and people won't be calling for any kind of overall repeal. But I wouldn't expect that people will say, don't take away my Obamacare. I mean, you're not going to hear that just because that's not the way the law works.
Right. Bruce Moll, what's your takeaway from this?
I have to agree with Gruber. I think it has come off here pretty well. It's not a very controversial subject around here. And we may be, as he says we're not, but we may be a crazy liberal state. I don't know. But it seems to be working well, and it doesn't solve the cost issue, as we've discovered. But I do think a lot of the things in the law would be popular about ensuring college, students up to 26. A lot of facets of it, I think, will be very popular.
Well, let's talk about some of the political implications of this decision. Peter, this morning, Republican Senator Scott Brown wrote in your paper that the federal law may be constitutional, but it's bad policy. He says it delivers no additional benefits to Massachusetts, just higher costs, higher taxes, and more regulations. And here's a statement from Senate, part of a statement aired by us right here on WBUR.
The law is bad for jobs, especially in Massachusetts. It raises 18 new taxes, including the job-killing tax on more than the 400 medical device companies in our state.
His Democratic opponent, Elizabeth Warren, supports the federal law. She spoke to WBUR yesterday.
What the Republicans want to do is go back to Washington and fight again over health care. They want to tear all of those benefits up from square one and just fight, fight, fight. And I just think that's the wrong direction to go. We need to move forward.
So, Bruce, how do you think this issue plays out as we move toward November? Some have suggested this election could be a referendum on the health care law. What do you think? How does it play out in these races?
I don't think it becomes a referendum on the health care law so much, because for so many people, it's too confusing. It's too goes all over the place. It's pretty clear the Republicans are going to take what the decision gave them, which is this is a tax, and the Republicans are going to run that this is an unfair, as Brown was just noting, there are multiple taxes in this bill, and that's what they're going to run on. I think it's a little difficult. Both Romney and Brown have difficulties in doing that, coming from Massachusetts as their primary liability.
Of course, this has been the big sort of a bugaboo that Romney has had to contend with throughout the campaign to date. Peter, what do you make? Does this, obviously, victory for the president, victory for Democrats, but a big fat target for Republicans?
It is a target for Republicans. Getting back to the Senate race here, though, I think Scott Brown has one good point about the medical device tax. As we all know, the House plan had been for there to be a tax on some so-called Cadillac health plans, which currently are untaxed. So employers of rich employees can put a lot of stuff in the health plan that isn't really related to core health, and for private rooms and for special treatment and home health aides and things like that. Stuff that probably should be taxed, and that would cover the expenses for Obamacare. Because of Scott Brown's election, they weren't able to go back and redo the bill in the Senate. So the House came around to the medical device tax sort of somewhat reluctantly, and that was the way that they got it through. I think they do need to go back and fix the medical device tax, because it does disproportionately harm one side of the healthcare equation, and it happens to be a side that's very big here in Massachusetts. That's his one good point. But the larger point, the 18 separate taxes, that includes a lot of little things that won't strike anybody. It's sort of poll-tested words, but it's not anything of great significance.
Well, yesterday, speaking of how this might sort of animate political races here in Massachusetts, we spoke yesterday to former Republican State Senator Richard Tesei, who's running for Congress, challenging John Tierney in the state 6th district. He actually talked about that tax on the medical device company on medical device companies as well. But he also said that if he were elected, he would join Republicans in trying to repeal the law.
I'm happy I voted for the bill here in Massachusetts, but I certainly don't want to impose what we did here in Massachusetts on other states, because it's still a work in progress here.
So, Peter, like Mitt Romney, he was for it in Massachusetts, against it for the nation. Is that an even harder argument to make if you're running for Congress?
I think it is a harder argument to make, especially, Mitt Romney's running in the nation as a whole, where
right.
The law is quite unpopular. Tesei is running here in Massachusetts, where it's quite popular. So it's a harder argument for Tesei to make than Romney to make.
Yeah, what do you think, Bruce Moll, about how this might animate the race, and specifically about that point that Tesei was making?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to get him anything. I think the same applies to Brown, because, as he said in the op-ed, he supported the Massachusetts health care law but doesn't want to impose it on everybody else wants to correct the problems in the federal law. I just think it's not a big issue.
Well, there's one other thing, too. A lot of the Republican candidates are saying, well, we're just going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something that's so much better. I'm convinced that they want to repeal Obamacare, but I can't imagine that they could begin to start crafting a big bill that's going to provide, something much better. I mean, I think there's just no will at all there. So it amounts to kind of an empty campaign statement that the chances of that happening, I would say, are as close to zero as you can possibly get in politics.
Well, speaking of Republican Richard Tesei's race for Congress, there are lots of other issues in that race, specifically regarding incumbent Democrat Congressman John Tierney. He continues to confront accusations that he was fully aware of an illegal offshore gambling operation run by his brothers-in-law. Now, the brother of John Tierney's wife was sentenced yesterday to 3 years in jail, and he claimed that Tierney knew everything.
Tierney strenuously denies that, and earlier this afternoon he told WBUR that his brother-in-law is disgruntled and making things up now that he's been found guilty.
That's pretty clear, and I think the public gets that. I think they also get the notion that others, like people that would, Republicans who would like to have the seat, would like to sort of use innuendo and insinuation to put, to attack what has been a lifetime of honesty and integrity, and that's what they feel they have to do, because if we get to the issues and what we've done over 16 years, they're clearly going to lose.
Now, Peter, let's just remind listeners, Congressman John Tierney's wife, Patrice Tierney, pleaded guilty to helping one of her brothers keep the books and spent a month in jail denies that her husband, John Tierney, knew anything about this. He fought this off 2 years ago, but what does it do to the race this time around against Richard Tesei?
Well, certainly these comments have put it sort of legitimately front and center in the race, whereas in the past, Tesei was kind of struggling in a way that was sort of borderline dirty politics to try to bring up something that had appeared to have been a settled issue, Patrice Tierney having been, you know, pled guilty a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But now that the brother-in-law is up making this charge, it's going to put it front and center. So it's a very bad development for Tierney.
Yeah. And Bruce Moll, Republicans like their chances of possibly picking up a seat here. Richard Tesei, a moderate Republican, openly gay, he casts himself as a moderate in the mold of Scott Brown, although even more liberal on social issues. How do you say this? See this race playing out?
I think it's going to be very tight. You know, he ran with Charlie Baker to be the lieutenant governor of the state. They didn't win, but he ran a very credible campaign. I think people perceive him as a very legitimate challenger. And I think he's been waiting. I think he's been raising significant amounts of money, and he's been waiting for something to break to draw attention to this race. And who knows, but this could be his break on that front.
Peter Kanellis, do you agree with that? Your take on Richard Tesei as a candidate for Congress?
I think he is a strong candidate, and this is clearly a break for him. You know, when the responses from the various people came by, I get all the emails, the press emails, and when I saw Tesei's strong words on the health care law, I was a little surprised by that because that's not a winning issue for him, and I'm surprised that he's taking it on so strongly. Because otherwise the race looks quite promising for him.
Well, it's time now, if we could, to shift gears quite significantly from politics to gangsters. And we learned this week that Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger, who faces 19 counts of murder, will argue that the charges should be dismissed because he had an agreement with the FBI that protected him from prosecution. Here's Bulger's attorney, J.W. Carney.
It is noteworthy that during a period of time when the government alleges that Mr. Bulger was engaged in a huge number of criminal activities, he was never once charged by this office. We contend it was because of the immunity agreement he had received.
That's attorney J.W. Carney. Meanwhile, after a hearing in federal court this week, Bulger's lawyers succeeded in having his trial pushed back 4 months to March 4th, arguing they need more time to prepare for this very complex case. So what do we make of this development? It's a known fact that a while ago Bulger was working for the FBI, but immunity? Peter, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think he has to have some sort of defense, and this is not a, you know, entirely far-fetched kind of theory, but there's no grant of immunity for murder, and you know, John Connolly, the FBI agent who had been dealing with him, has already been put in prison. So I don't imagine this being an actual obstacle to finding Bulger guilty, but I'm not surprised that he's making it an issue.
Well, I think U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz would agree with you. Here was her response earlier this week.
Being an informant in a criminal case does not in and of itself immunize you from crimes.
Bruce Moll, I'd love to get your take on this. I mean, if not immunity, does this at least sort of re-shine that spotlight on the way the FBI was sort of mixed up in the dirty business back in the old days with Bulger?
Absolutely. I don't really pretend to understand the intricacies of the legal issues here, but I think this is a sort of shot by Bulger's attorney that everything's on the table and the FBI is on the table. And their deals with Bulger on the table. And I think it's going to be, they're sort of showing that this is going to make, they're going to make it uncomfortable for the U.S. Attorney's mm-hmm. Office to prosecute this case.
Yeah. Do you agree with that, Peter Kanellis?
Yes. And I think that you know, there had been rumors during the time that Bulger was on the lam that, you know, maybe the FBI didn't really want to catch him because he was going to come out and implicate other agents and things like that. You know, that is a shot from what we just heard from Carney was a shot to the government, sort of suggesting that he's going to try to turn this into a referendum on them and their own actions surrounding Bulger, and so we'll have to see what comes out.
A few months to go, be an interesting case to watch. Gentlemen, that brings us to our weekly hubbub, that story that didn't quite make it above the fold. And I said, gentlemen, let's start with you, Magna. Lady and gentlemen, let's start with you, Magna, with your hubbub is what I'm trying to get out of my clumsy mouth here.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, my hubbub has to do with the journalism's responsibility to get it right. And that this is vis-a-vis yesterday's Supreme Court decision. I mean, you, me, everyone was probably sitting there with multiple screens in front of us trying to figure out, as the news was bubbling up on the internet, what was really going on. CNN and Fox News famously or infamously, I should say, got it wrong first and foremost when it was clear that the Commerce Clause wasn't going to be used to hold up the Affordable Care Act. Jeff Toobin later comes on and says, well, it took a while for Chief Justice Roberts to read his decision, so finally when he got to the part about it being a tax, that's when we understood what was really going on. But by that time, it was too late, because in the era that we live in, with Twitter and other news outlets, you know, including even Diane Rehm on NPR just sort of saying what they saw on CNN, you know, it took a while for the record to be corrected. And I just, you know, it was just a good reminder that we in journalism have this responsibility to want to inform people, but to do it accurately and with the most context as possible, because just because you're first doesn't mean you're right, and being right matters most of all. So that's my hubbub for all of us here in the biz.
Here. Being right is more important than being fast in this business. Bruce Small, your hubbub.
Mine is a little noticed story this week. There was a rally at the State House yesterday, on Thursday, by a bunch of teenagers from Lowell. It's very typical for kids or classes to come up to Beacon Hill and get a bill passed into law that is pretty innocuous, like the state's muffin or the state tree or something like that. But these kids are trying to get the right to vote at the age of 17 in municipal elections in Lowell. And they're out there rallying, they're lobbying, they're trying to get this passed. They've still got a long way to go because time is running out. But it was great to see that 17-year-olds are trying to get the right to participate in the public process. And that was refreshing to see.
Refreshing, great story. Peter Canellos, how about your hubbub?
Time is running out because they're going to be 18, right? That's the problem. My hubbub, a lot of people have bemoaned the fact that there are so few bookstores left in Boston, only one mainstream bookstore, Barnes & Noble at Prudential Center. So it was good news that Macy's in Downtown Crossing is going to be adding a book department, a little branch of the same bookstore that exists in South Station, sort of the book nook that exists in South Station. So it's a sign that those of us who like to browse through bookstores will at least continue to have some places where we can go.
Well, here's mine. It's about Pax Centurion. This is the newsletter of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, and advertisers are continuing to flee from it because of a series of ugly comments that Pax Centurion has been published. These include ugly stereotypes about women, about Arabs, undocumented immigrants, the Occupy Boston protesters, not to mention Police Commissioner Ed Davis himself, who they compare to the late North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il, Governor Patrick, who they label a racial huckster, and all of Jamaica Plain, which they label a busybody community concerned with everybody else's business because they basically have no lives of their own. So I guess you can give the editors credit for at least being equal opportunity offenders. But the backlash is serious. It began Wednesday. Simmons College pulled their ads in response to protests on Facebook. LoJack and Harpoon Brewery have followed suit. And for his part, Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis tweeted yesterday, "This juvenile conduct is wrong and not representative of today's officer." And I want to believe that he's correct about that. But anyway, that's my hubbub for this week. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us today, and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony. Same to you.
And Bruce Mole, editor of Commonwealth Magazine, great to see you, and have a good weekend as well.
Thank you. You too.